You're listening to Big Ideas, the only regularly scheduled television program in North America devoted to the art of the lecture and the importance of ideas in public life. It is broadcast on TVO every Saturday and Sunday at 4 p.m. For more information on our program, go to our website at tvo.org/bigideas.
I'm going to take a break from my usual, I don't know if you call it my usual speech or my usual script. I want to tell you about my ideas, sure, and the ideas that are behind the rise of the creative class and this kind of new creative society we're all living in, and also the new book, Who's Your City, and why place is so important in our lives. I'll tell you about that, and we have plenty of time, but I also want to tell you something about coming to those ideas, and in a way, me becoming an author. I grew up in a very, very tough working class part of New Jersey. I'm Italian-American. My grandparents came to the United States. I was born in Newark, and my parents migrated to North Arlington, smack dab in the heart of Sopranos country. Really, I grew up between the Pizza Land Pizzeria and the Bada Bing Club, if you know the Sopranos. And grew up with a very, very tough group of peers. Always liked to read. We'll get to that. Didn't know what to read. Went to Catholic school. And went to college because my parents wanted me to go to local Catholic college because Italian kids didn't go far away. And I got a Garden State scholarship from my state or province, New Jersey. And going to college changed my life because at college I could be smart and read books and not get beat up. Because where I grew up, if you were smart and you read books, kids just thought you were a nerd or a geek or they had worse words for it and they beat the crap out of you. So, but in college, you know, my parents called a lot of interventions. I like to have fun, but that's not why they called the interventions, because they wanted me to find a career. They wanted me to give up guitar. They wanted me to cut my hair and shave my beard and take the earring out. And so the first intervention they called was to tell me that I had to study pre-medicine. Just think about this if you know my work. I had to study pre-medicine, and I said, no, I don't like these subjects. So then they called another, and they brought all, not only my aunts and uncles, but like all my cousins together for this. They said, okay, we understand you don't want to be a doctor. You should be a dentist. You should be a dentist. And I said, no, I'm not really handy with drills. I don't have a lot of hand-eye coordination. So they said, well, they called the final intervention my freshman year, and they said, well, Richard, you obviously like to talk a lot. You should be a lawyer. And I really said I was going to do that. Until I was a senior, and I still played in the band and really thought we were going to, you know, be a band, and kind of went from being a kind of hippie, psychedelic rock guitar player to trying to play new wave, which was all the rage at the time in the mid to late 70s, new wave and punk. And finally, I'm thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? So I said, instead of going to law school, I'll apply for PhD programs. So I went off to MIT and found it was interesting, wanted to move back to New York City, so transferred off to Columbia University, which was a spectacular time to be in New York City in the early 1980s, and decided I should give up the guitar and be an academic. So I began to study subjects, urban planning, urban affairs, read Jane Jacobs. I was in a program in city and regional planning and study these things and pay them attention. But if you want to be an author, I can tell you this, with all respect to my academic colleagues, that the PhD program is probably the worst place to ever be. And it's very interesting. I guess my natural inclination was to be an essayist and to write social commentary, but of course you're not allowed to do that. As a social scientist, you have to, and this is very interesting and it's important, you have to have hypotheses that are testable, you have to have large data sets, you don't have case examples, you don't develop narrative strategies, you just write with the facts and you present them in the theoretical conceptual mumbo-jumbo of your field, which no one else can penetrate. So I did that, and the overriding ethos in my field was this question of, I guess, thinking about the time. Now, I'm getting out with a PhD in the mid-1980s. Many, many parts of North America were experiencing economic transformation. Still ongoing today. You know, Windsor and Detroit what my professors called at that time deindustrialization. That was what we were being shaped by. Many people in the field were influenced by what you would have called at the time a Marxist or neo-Marxist view of these phenomena, especially in city regional planning and especially in urban geography. And what they were talking about was the movement away, the shift, we now call it globalization, the offshoring, the outsourcing, the deindustrialization of jobs. So I got very interested in how you would create new jobs. And at the time, I was doing two kinds of projects. I was working on projects about where high technology industries locate, where these high tech, fancy biotech software, robotic, semiconductor, computer industries locate. We called this high technology restructuring. Economic restructuring was a term we used for it. And why they developed themselves into industrial clusters, typically around universities. We said, if you have that, you'll generate entrepreneurial business formation and you'll create jobs. The second thing I got interested in was the in-migration and the location of all of these foreign companies. Now, I was teaching at Ohio State University at the time, and I was watching North American Big Three companies close their factories, but seeing all of these really interesting Japanese Honda and Toyota plants open up factories. And I began to write on what this meant. Foreign. Now, think about how boring. Sorry, boring. This is foreign direct investment, job creation, factory production. Oh, I can go on with the words, you know, the jargon. We wrote these articles, spatial restructuring, in place, in situ, investment, this and that, clusters. So I began to write these projects, but very captivated by all of this. Why some jobs disappear, why some factories disappear, why some jobs now are growing, and some communities begin to thrive. Well, I moved to Pittsburgh in 1984. And if you think what's happening in Windsor and Detroit is bad now, Pittsburgh was dealt an economic body blow. Pittsburgh was dealt an economic body blow, a tsunami of economic hardship. That town lost 150,000 jobs in just a 2 to 3 year period. It saw its population decline from a high of 900,000 to 8, to 7, to 6, to 5, to 4. Its population now is 330,000. So you're talking about a fundamental economic hurricane. And the reason I went to Pittsburgh and took a job at Carnegie Mellon was because they were trying to figure out how to rebuild their economy. Now, by this time, I had become totally immersed in my field, forgotten completely how to write. But my field had this very basic notion that if you wanted to grow your economy, you had to attract industry. And the reason you would attract industry, either foreign direct investment or new companies or form these economic clusters of high-tech companies like they had in the San Francisco area, the reason was because you would have to create the jobs that people would want to work in, the good, high-paying jobs. That's at the bottom of my field. The more I could look, that was the notion that if a company would come or you would form a company, you would create a good high-paying job, a lot of good high-paying jobs, those high-tech jobs, they would be phenomenal and people would take the jobs and you would have a thriving town. Well, in Pittsburgh, we tried to develop a strategy to save the town and rejuvenate the town. Even though the companies had left, the industrialization, there were two great universities, actually more than two great universities, but two spectacular universities, Carnegie Mellon, where I taught software, computer science, robotics, entertainment technology. The University of Pittsburgh, just across the street, biomedicine, biotech, where Dr. Jonas Salk invented the polio vaccine. The idea was if you put those together with what the companies had in the town, even though the factories had closed, the companies still had their research places, their research laboratories. Whether that was U.S. Steel or National Steel or Gulf Oil or Rockwell Aerospace or Alcoa in aluminum, Westinghouse, one of the world's great electronic companies from Pittsburgh, all of those companies had their research units. Take the company's research units, plug them into the university, get them cooperating together, you could create high-tech spin-off companies. They created the world's first technology council, the Pittsburgh Technology Council. They created the world's first university industry partnership program. They named it after Ben Franklin, the great Pennsylvania Philadelphia inventor. All of these programs, entrepreneurship, technology transfer, commercialization, still words you hear to this day even in Toronto and around Canada. Things we have to do to spur the high-tech, innovative, technology-driven companies. We generated company after company. We created a company at Carnegie Mellon, which was one of the first big internet companies. I tell the story in Rise of the Creative Class. It was called Lycos. Lycos was one of the first companies to define the internet space, to aggregate information, to help people use the internet. Two computer scientists at Carnegie Mellon formed the company. And boy, oh boy, it was growing like crazy. And then by this time now, I had become so embedded in academia, and I had written so many truly boring books that nobody remembers, but they're on the CV, and hundreds of these papers. Went up to Harvard to go on sabbatical and was working at the Kennedy School of Government in their Center for Science, Technology, and Economic Performance. So true center of geekdom, right? Studying how economies thrive, innovate, why science and discovery are important to technological advance, working with economists and innovation theorists and also biologists and physicists, Nobel Prize winners from around Cambridge, MIT, Harvard, around the world, North America, Europe, Asia. We wrote a book. Think about this title, Industrializing Knowledge. Yikes. Even scares me to think, Industrializing Knowledge. About how Pittsburgh was a model, a focal point for combining university, industry, technology, rejuvenating old economically declining areas, drawing on cases from Pittsburgh and around the world. And then one day something happened that truly changed my life. I drove my car in the morning into the Kennedy School parking lot. I got my cup of espresso. I'm feeling very great. You know, I'm at Harvard, a copy of the Boston Globe, the morning paper, and I go up to my office, you know, overlooking the Charles River and the square. And I opened the paper to a headline that in retrospect really changed my life, because the headline read, Lycos to move to Boston. And I said to myself, holy moly. I actually used a slightly different version of that phrase. I said to myself, holy moly, something really strange is going on here, because this was an effort, a major effort on the part of Pittsburgh to rebuild itself. And here was this company picking up from Pittsburgh and moving. Not only moving, this was a company that was tied into the belly of the research and economic technology apparatus of Carnegie Mellon and the local community in Pittsburgh. Why the heck would they be moving? And, you know, in my field, I kind of knew, I understood, I wrote books, I wrote papers, I taught my students that if you had those high-paying, high-tech, high-value Lycos jobs, you're going to be a winner. Because if you have those Lycos jobs, the people are going to come to them, especially those high-pay, high-tech jobs. When I looked into it, everything that I thought I knew about economics, something was wrong. First of all, Boston was a much higher cost of business location than Pittsburgh. The cost of taxes, the cost of property, the cost of office space, the cost of salaries was much, 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 much higher in Boston than in Pittsburgh. Secondly, one of the things we talk about in my field, or talked about, was if you want to move a company, the mayor gives them a handout, an incentive for relocation. An industrial incentive. The mayor of Boston gave them no such industrial incentive. And I was quite puzzled. So I called my friends back at Carnegie Mellon. I knew people at Lycos. I called them. I put my best students back at Carnegie Mellon on this case. And the answer that came back really floored me. No industrial incentive, higher cost in Boston than Pittsburgh. Why were they moving? To get access to a talented, energetic, innovative group of people, talent they called them, that was already in Boston. They said to try to recruit those people to Pittsburgh would take too much time. What went off in my head is that there was something wrong with my field. There was something wrong with the way that I approach problems and something wrong with the stuff I was writing and what I was teaching my students. And I don't know how or why, but what went off in my head is we had always believed that if you create the jobs with the high salaries, the people will move to them. But instead of people moving to jobs like they were supposed to, in this case, the jobs were moving to the people. And I couldn't get that out of my head. But I woke up one day, and I'm going to tell you the truth, on the air. I said, this stuff is BS. This stuff I'm talking about and writing about in my field is BS. And you know what? I'm writing it for an audience of six people. I'm writing it for an audience of six puffy-chested guys. Sorry. Six puffy-chested guys who think they know the answer, who never went out there and talked to a single human being instead of their academic colleagues. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out and talk to people. So I didn't have a research budget. And by the way, until I moved here to the I always had research money before. Until I moved here to the University of Toronto doing the work on the creative economy, the creative class, all the stuff you might have heard I write about, No one in the United States would fund that research. So I didn't have a penny of research funding to do this. So what I did, I went back to Carnegie Mellon in the fall, and I said to my students, and I said this for a specific reason, because my students were either seniors graduating, they're advanced undergraduates, or they were master school graduates. So they were going to graduate in a year or two. They were going to have to make a career decision and a job decision, an employment decision, and a location decision. I said, when you graduate, where do you guys think you will work, and where do you want to live? The answers that came back blew me away. Not a one of them said they would stay in Pittsburgh. Not a single one. And how they were orienting their search for work, the things they wanted in their life, the things they were looking for in balancing work, career, and job, the kinds of places they were looking to live in, I had no clue. So I said to myself at that time, I have to start to write this down. I have to start to write this stuff down. And I have an obligation to write it down. And I don't care if the people in my field think I'm from the moon. And so I began the writing process. And I wrote a whole variety of versions of what became Rise of the Creative Class. I couldn't figure out what to call it. And this is really interesting. And I met a really wonderful editor in New York named Bill Frucht. And Bill Frucht has helped me shape that book, and he helped me shape Hoosier City. I worked with him on two projects. Bill had a huge effect on me as an editor. And this is really key, as a collegial editor. Much more effect than any academic colleague, because he pushed me. What he pushed me to do was he said, Richard, you have described an interesting world out there. You've described an interesting world of changes out there. Your academic colleagues might like it, but you don't have any way to engage people. He said, look, you're talking about a force bigger than just these descriptive changes. He's the one who forced me to think about this construct of the creative class. He said, Richard, what you're talking about in the changes in the way people dress, in the way people work, in the kinds of communities we live in, what you're talking about is the rise of a new class, like the working class 200 years ago that Marx wrote about, that worked to the rhythms of the industrial factories, that punched an 8-to-5 time clock, that moved to these big, giant cities, that formed itself into a class. Now, your class is more amorphous. It's more diffuse. But the people you were talking about, the artists, the writers, the designers, the musicians, the techies, the biotech people, the computer programmers, the website designers, and the professional people in research and publishing and broadcasting and legal and financial and health sectors, they are really part of a class. And just like that working class had steel workers and auto workers and craftsmen and welders and electricians and carpenters who all saw themselves as somewhat different, your class too. Sure, the researcher doesn't see himself the same as an artist. The musician doesn't see herself the same as a designer. Nobody sees themselves, you know, like a physician or an engineer. But they're all the same. And he talked about a description I had in the book of going to a little party and not being able to tell who was the engineer, who was the artist, who was in publishing, because I couldn't tell among the young people. I couldn't put them in their relevant suit, relevant outfit. So Bill pushed me to come up with this idea of the rise of the creative class. We published the book. I cannot tell you how it changed my life. But the most amazing thing was in publishing that book, one, the development of people who I never thought would read my work, and what they saw in my work and how they saw it, to the response of academia, which basically said, Florida has lost his mind. What happened, though, is although academics were kind of taken back by this, and even, what's very interesting, even some of my core audience of economic development professionals, the book began to resonate with people in arts, culture, writing, community development, community activists. And here's what they resonated with, which you have to understand what's such a mind blower to me. One, I had peppered the manuscript only to try to shed light on some of my own thinking with some stories about my dad and other people I had come across in my life. People resonated with those personal stories, which I had never used before, and I didn't know why I was writing them. I was not writing those strategically. I was writing those to illuminate points in my own thinking. And secondly, they identified with this phenomenon called the creative class. They had a personal identification with this phenomenon called the creative class. And then I said, oh boy, If I felt obligated to write the book and begin to write in English and begin to communicate with people, then I felt that I had an even bigger obligation to begin to defend these ideas and to begin to go out and share these ideas and help to empower people in communities that I began to understand were struggling to make these, who, you know, in a sense, I wasn't writing anything new. What I was doing was just writing what I saw in the world. Most of my colleagues were afraid to observe the world. They were afraid to go out and talk to people. They lived in a very hermetically sealed, we call it an ivory tower, whatever. But once I began to observe the world and talk to people, all I was really doing was collating all of these observations. Now, the first thing that I was able to conclude is that we are going through a monumental shift in the nature of our economy and our society. A monumental shift in the nature of our economy and society, which a shift, you know, like we had a shift before from a farm-based society or an agricultural age to an industrial age, like we had that shift before, that big shift 100 or 200 years ago, people beginning to leave the farms, work in factories, work in these giant industrial communities like Detroit or Pittsburgh or Windsor or even Toronto, Buffalo, all across North America and the world. And like that changed the way we organize our time, the way we work, the rhythms of our day, the shift we are going through now in our life was even bigger. What I found is we were shifting from an industrial kind of society and economy to a new one. Other people had come up with other words for it. They called it an information age. They called it a technology age. They called it an internet age. They called it a new economy. They called it a knowledge economy. What I began to see is that there was something more basic and fundamental going on. That the shift we were going through was from an industrial economy to a creative economy. You know, high-tech industries only compose about 6% of our total economy in North America. So I began to see this as a much broader shift to a creative economy. And a shift where it was no longer raw materials or natural resources or stuff we could pump out of the ground or human physical labor that motivated our work and our economic growth. It was the human mind, human creative capabilities. In this global age where manufacturing can move offshore and be done in lower cost environments, I began to see this incredible shift in work away from and value creation, away from physical labor to mental labor, intellectual labor, and then information. No, much more basic thing, human creativity. So we identified the creative segment of the economy, and we called this, with Bill, my editor's help, the creative class. That's scientists, engineers, innovators, researchers, entrepreneurs, high technology people. That's artists, writers, editors, broadcasters, designers, musicians, all sorts of people who work in entertainment fields, and the knowledge-based professionals. Just to give you some backgrounding, in the year 1900, more than 50% of North Americans worked in or around the farm sector, the ag sector, in or around the farm. Growing number of us worked in manufacturing. Less than 5% of us worked in these creative occupations. By the year 1950, we had become a manufacturing industrial economy. Now 50% of us worked in or around factories, massive migration off the farms to these factory towns. Less than 10% of us worked in the creative sector. The year 1980, the year I was graduating college, still less than about 15% of us worked in the creative segment of the economy. Since that time, since 1980 to today, we added 25 to 30 million jobs in North America in the creative segment of the economy. Today, nearly 50 million of us in North America, 50 million of us in North America work in the creative economy. In the U.S., it's about 35%. In Canada, it's about 37% of all employment. Working class, manufacturing, is 22 or 23%. The creative class, this creative segment of the economy, is a third to 40, and in some of the Scandinavian countries, nearly 50% of all employment. 150 million people worldwide. If you add up all wages and salaries paid in North America, you divide our economy into three pieces: manufacturing, service, traditional service, hotel service, retail trade, food service, landscaping, those jobs, and the creative segment, science, technology, arts, entertainment, writing, and the like. The creative segment of the economy already produces more than 50% of all wages and salaries. In North America, we're going to generate another 20 million jobs in the creative sector of the economy over the next decade. This creative segment of the economy, this creative sector, this creative class is to our time what the working class and the industrial segment was to my grandfather and father's time. This is the growth force of our economy. And just to make this plain, if automotive and steel were two of the core sectors of the industrial age, today already, just entertainment, not even high tech, just entertainment alone is a larger industrial sector than automotive or steel. This is what's changing our lives. This is what's changing. Look around the room. Look at the gender composition of this room. The rise of the creative sector is what's affecting the demographics of our workforce. Look at the way we're dressed. Look at how we're not all strapped into suits and ties and businessman, organization man garb. Look at the way we work. Look at the rise of flexible scheduling, telecommuting. Look at all the changes around us. I talk about these in Rise of the Creative Class. I use a time traveler device where I bring a time traveler and move that time traveler from 1900 to 1950, from 1950 to the year 2000. From 1900 to 1950, I say, the time traveler would observe massive technological change. All sorts of new gizmos and devices and different kinds of technologies, from cars to planes to trains and all the like. From 1950 to 2000, there'd be some new technology. There'd be computers in the office and cell phones. But the massive change that time traveler would see is social, is cultural. Massive move of women in the workforce, changes in dress and scheduling, changes in the way people work, the rise of active forms of leisure. The fact that the people I was interviewing wanted to live in cities and communities that were filled with joggers and walkers and bicyclists and outdoor cafes and places to stop and mingle. Well, that's not epiphenomenal. That's not something that's just happening for the fun of it. This isn't just fun and games when you look around these neighborhoods and see people jogging and running and riding bicycles and going for coffee in the middle of the day and nobody has a tie and nobody looks like they're working, of course. When you work with your mind, you need forms of physical release. Now I began to get critics. And I really enjoyed criticism. It took a while. It was very hurtful for any author at first because once you become a public intellectual, it isn't a polite academic criticism. It then is a personal attack on you. But so here's what came back. When people heard the term creative class, they got kind of bridled. And what they bridled at was this idea that the creative class is an elitist construct. They heard this word and they said, class, that's an elite group. Now, that were the smart ones. There was another group of people who in the United States, less so in Canada, but in the United States, if you're familiar with the dialogue there, are kind of socially conservative. Yeah, kind of socially conservative. And they got really, really, really bridled by some of the interesting findings in the book. One of the interesting findings was, the way it occurred was very interesting, because we went into this all with a sense of humor. We're trying to find ways to explain why some places grow faster and better and stronger than others, why some places are doing more better economically, and why places like Pittsburgh that had great research universities, great technology, great innovative people, had a Jonas Salk, were home to a place like Andy, a person like Andy Warhol, Mark Cuban, who the inventor of Broadcast.com, why Pittsburgh couldn't harness that, why those people were migrating out. So we're looking for these other factors other than economic factors. So we're sitting around a nice table like this in my house, a round table. Yeah, I lived right up near the university. My graduate students coming over. I said, could we build a measure of artistic and cultural innovation? Well, you know, you can count public broadcasts, symphony performances. You can count ballets, da-da-da-da-da. I didn't like any of those. I said, could we actually measure people who do creative artistic work? Can we measure writers, musicians, painters, visual artists, on and on? They're like, well, the census department counts all of them. So I said, I just blurted out, why don't we make a bohemian index? And, of course, my students who are very capable people said, sure, we'll make a bohemian index. Let's go count them all up. Well, when we did the statistics, the students are very good at this, once we did the statistical analysis, what came out was this bohemian index factor, the number of artists and writers and entertainers, media people in your town, had a huge effect at that town's economic situation. The more of those, keeping all other factors equal, in most places, the more of those kinds of people, the more vibrant and innovative and technologically than, you know, places that had, like San Francisco, places that had an active writing community. that had writers in the 50s. Then they started to attract some of the artists, and then the musicians came in the 60s, and the Jefferson Airplane, and the Grateful Dead, and Country Joe and the Fish. And what we're seeing is that that place had an open-mindedness. An open-mindedness, an ability to attract creative thinking people. Some of those people were engineers. Some of those people had new ideas about how to make semiconductors. So they weren't necessarily nestled side by side. They didn't even know one another. But there was something in the ecology or the DNA of that place, something in its bones, if you will, the eco-system of the San Francisco Bay Area, that was open to these creative thinking people, the creative class. So, boom. Then one of my friends said, you should meet this guy named Gary Gates, because you and him are coming to the same conclusions. Gary was a graduate doctoral student. He's now a professor at UCLA. And I was studying the high-tech creative people, where they're going, where they're locating. So you should meet Gary Gates. I said, oh, why? He said, because Gary is studying the location of gay men. Like, are you crazy? Why would I want to meet Gary Gates? I mean, my research has nothing to do with the location areas of gay men. But I'm a professor. He's a graduate student. I said, fine, I'll meet with him. Well, anyway, I learned Gary has a great sense of humor. Now I've since learned why he has a great sense of humor, dealing with the sensitive subject, at least in the U.S. case. So Gary said to me when he met me, he wanted to diffuse any tension. He said, Rich, could you give me a list of your five top creative class, high-tech, super spots, hot spots? I said, sure, Gary, that's San Francisco, that's Boston, that's Seattle, that's Austin, Texas, and that's San Diego. He said, congratulations, Richard, you've just named 5 of the 10 gayest cities in America. And we looked at the list. And Gary had invented this gay index because at that point we didn't count. We didn't ask people in the census if they were gay. So he had to figure out a way to identify this using statistical procedures and matching, you know, two people in a household, same sex, been there for X number of years. He could create a construct measure of this. So then we did a research project, put it all together, and boy, oh boy, what came out is places that had large concentrations of gay men and gay and lesbians. Also, it had this same effect for the same reason that we said. It wasn't that gay men drive economic growth. They're all the high-tech entrepreneurs. It wasn't that artists become techies. No, these are small populations together, less than 8% of the total population of the United States, all bohemians, all gays, put them together. It wasn't that. It was that they were indicating, leading indicators of a place that was open-minded, open to new thinking, could attract people who didn't fit in, were looking for a way to start a new gallery, a new publishing company, write their great novel, write their memoir, or start this great high-tech, innovative company. They were indicative of that kind of place. Here's what Rise of the Creative Class says. The basic message of Rise of the Creative Class is in the opening chapter. Every single human being is creative. The great challenge of our time is to untap, uncork, harness that creative energy that lies deep within, the creative furnace that lies deep within every single human being. And so I just want to communicate that for a minute, where that comes from, because I've been forced to introspect. It comes from two places, really. The first and self-evident place it came from that I understood was my studies of factories in the 1980s, in the Midwest, in the Ohios and Michigans of the world. When I studied those factories, I mentioned why the old factories were closing and the new Honda and Toyotas were growing. And by the way, just as a point, I think this distinction between a new and old economy, we read it in the papers here, is wrong. If the Ontario isn't going through a shift, or Canada isn't going through a shift, for a new to an old to a new economy, there are just companies that don't harness creativity and companies that do harness creativity. For every big three General Motors or Ford, there's a Toyota. And the same thing goes in the grocery industry or any other industry. There are a lot of companies in the grocery industry that are dying, but there's companies like Whole Foods that treat their workers like human beings and harness their creativity. Look at the ag sector. Look at the ag sector in Canada. Look at the rise of the ice wines and the designer cheese and all the new organic meat. Those companies are growing because they harness innovation and creativity. Even companies in simple chairs, like the one right down here, Umbra. Here's a company that's growing by leaps and bounds, making chairs and furniture and garbage pails, while other companies making those commodities dry. The point is that every single human being is creative, and creativity can be harnessed in any industry. So I realized I learned this in my studies of the factory. I realized I learned this not by studying artists and musicians and editors and writers and bohemian factor. I learned it in my studies of Toyota. What did I learn when I went to the Toyota factory? Toyota told me 20 years ago, we're going to win. We're going to beat GM. We're going to beat Ford. We're going to beat all of them. And the reason, Richard, is in your heads. You in the West, you in North America, you in the U.S., you in Detroit think the big shot CEO Lee Iacocca type, what has all the answers, that big shot CEO surrounded by his, and I teach in a business school, the MBAs and the engineers. We know better. The key to success of Toyota lies in the tens of thousands of people who work in our factories. That's where our innovation comes from. They called it Kaizen. Kaizen. Continuous improvement up from the bottom. We let our workers design new production systems. We let our workers make their work process. We form them into teams. We tap their minds. Then I realized I learned this a long time ago from my father. While I was a young kid, I was very precocious. I wanted to understand what my dad did for work. And trust me, in the 60s and 70s, we did not have take your son to work day. My dad was very smart. Richard, study hard, get good grades, go to college, get ahead. You're not going to have to work in a factory like that. But I would beg and plead and stamp on the floor, take me to work. I want to see where you work. Well, when the factory was going overtime on Saturdays, my dad was very smart, and they'd go a half day, 8 to 12. He'd say, Rich, you can come with me on the Saturday. You can hang around. Then we'll go for lunch, and we'll spend the rest of the day together. I would go in there, and I would see the machines whirring and turning and making eyeglass frames. And, you know, just like this terminal's here, my dad would see me kind of glued to this machine going around and around and around. And he grabbed me by the shoulder. Later in life, many great CEOs have told me and business leaders have told me the same thing. My dad told me this first. He said, Rich, it's not the machines that make the factory great. It's not the technology that make the factory great. This stuff anybody can buy. It's the knowledge, it's the intelligence, and the creativity of the people who work here. You see those German guys over there who came from Germany working the machine tools? They didn't graduate high school. It's their intelligence. You see the Italians over here working in this segment, the Italian guys, like your dad and your uncles? Your uncle Mike, well, he didn't even have an eighth grade degree. He helped design the machine layout in here with your cousin Mike. They did that. You see the Puerto Rican and Hispanic people working over here? They helped us in these ways. They don't need big fancy degrees, Rich. They don't need to be the machine inventors. It's the knowledge, it's the creativity of the people who work here. Every single human being is creative. That's the challenge of our time. And I just want to say, that's the challenge of our time right here in Canada. It's a challenge of our time in Ontario. That's a challenge of our time in society. And that's the thing that I'm on. My mother would have called it Richard's on his high horse about. I'm on the high horse about this, but I got to be. My dad started that job when he was 13. He told me, Rich, nine of us. It took nine of us. Me, your Uncle Mike, our five sisters, Grandma and Grandpa, my grandmother had a job at a bakery, nine of us to make a family wage. He said, Rich, I came back from World War II and magic happened. I had this great job. Now, how did it happen that I left, I had a crap job, I came back, I had a great job, same factory, same job. He said, I had benefits, I had Social Security, I had health insurance, I had a high salary, I could buy a house and put you two boys through college, as if by magic. And I think the great challenge of our time is to do another magic act. Now, the creative people, sure, we're struggling. Sure, we have struggling artists. Sure, we have struggling musicians. Sure, some writers are tough. But not compared to the people who work in the service economy. Not the people who work in the remaining of the manufacturing economy. But the service, even worse. Why can't we turn their jobs into good jobs? And that's what I'm pushing on. How do we extend the creative economy across the whole society? Not just 30%, 40%. How do we make Toronto, Ontario, Canada, a place where everybody gets the... And I think these are basic human rights. I just have to say this. Basic human rights. There are two human rights that have to be added to the tablet. Number one is that every single human being has their right to use their God-given talent. Has a basic human right. And two, and I'll get to this in a second, and two, that every human being has the right to self-express and be the person we want to be. Once those two basic human rights are put on the plate, we'll win. Which brings you to the second point. If creativity is this basic human force, every human being is creative, we have to understand that creativity will not respect, does not correspond to, will not be bounded by the social categories we have imposed on ourselves. Creativity comes equally in both genders, cuts across all races, cuts across all ethnicities, cuts across all age groups, cuts across all family styles, doesn't care what your family was like, doesn't care if you're single, if you're married, doesn't care about your sexual orientation, doesn't care about if you're able-bodied or disabled. Creativity cuts across. That's why our findings began to show us that creativity crops up where you have diversity, where you have artistic and cultural and gender and sexual and immigrant, national, multinational diversity, you get these creative centers. Why? Because they're able to amass more and more creative people. Because they're able to tap and harness more and more of that. No, none of these places is doing it right. None of these places has extended it very far. Even the most advanced may include 40, 45, or 50% of their people in the creative economy. Nobody's gotten to 60 or 70 or 80 or 90, but we have to get there. So the key is to understand that creativity requires diversity. And then in another book I wrote, Flight of the Creative Class, I sort of laid this out. And I challenged the United States, country I was born in. I said, look, guys, this homeland security, visa restriction, immigrant restriction is destroying the basic strength of what made America's major city strong. It wasn't raw materials. It wasn't great ports. It wasn't big factories. It wasn't this ridiculous construct of American ingenuity. Those places like the Silicon Valley in California or New York were open to immigrants. 50% of those high-tech companies in Silicon Valley were founded by a foreign-born person. And in that book, I began to recognize and see challengers emerging. What I said in that book is that the United States faced its greatest challenge of all time, one, because it was restricting its inflow of people, two, because it was torn up in a culture war, a political war, political polarization, which you've just seen in the campaign, but three, because there were new kids on the block. There were new communities all over the world in North America, all of the great Canadian centers, Toronto, Vancouver, Montreal, Ottawa, and all the rest, which were actively going out there and attracting new Canadians, but not just in North America. The Australians, the New Zealand, the Sydneys, the Melbournes, the Aucklands, the Brisbanes, and even the UK getting this again, beginning to re-understand this, and Northern Europe. Now there was a global competition emerging for people. And one of the great things of our time is the world, even though it looks like we're in dark times, even though it looks like the economy's not doing well, even though we're embroiled in this crazy conflagration in the Middle East, even though things in the United States are not going the way many, many, most Americans would want them to go, there was this underlying optimism because for the first time in human history, our further economic development requires greater diversity, greater inclusiveness, and the further development of human creative capability. So in our time, and what was happening is we were going through that adjustment. And I said in that book, I'm not sure the United States is going to define that time. And now Fareed Zakaria has come out with a book about the post, a wonderful book about the post-American world. And now there are cities and communities, Canada, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Sydney, Brisbane, all around the world have defined their role in this post-American centric world. What an incredible opportunity. Now we all have an obligation to provide alternative models of how to harness creativity, how to build more inclusive communities, how to harness diversity, how to build attractive and engaged arts and cultural community, how to prevent ourselves from splitting apart in a class war. That now in this post-American world, this is our joint obligation. Well, lastly what caused me to write Who's Your City, and I want to talk about that book for a minute. I woke up one morning and said, okay, these ideas, the rise of the creative class, have gotten out to a pretty good-sized audience. Books sold a lot. But it's engaging a group of in-thinkers. It's engaging a group of people who listen to intellectually oriented public radio. It's engaging people who watch intellectually oriented talk shows. It's engaging people who are already book readers. It's engaging a thought leadership community, but I've got to try to push it out further. Because so many people are not aware of this. So many people don't read a lot. So many people don't tune into those talk shows. So many people are so overwhelmed. I've got to find a way to get this message out to a bigger group of people. So I just thought about my own life. And I thought about the big decisions in my life. I thought about my father pushing me to stay in school and study hard and get the career and the job. And I thought about when I turn on the boob tube and watch, you know, the really silly morning talk shows, they always have the segment on jobs and careers and what you have to do and graduation is coming and what you need to tell your kids, the fields that are growing. Okay. And then I thought about the other big set of advice we get in our life. What to do is the number one. I thought about the advice my mother gave me. My mother said, well, she always said this, Richard, your father's right. You got to study hard. You got to get a good job. You got to get good grades. Push hard on that. But she also said, you know, Rich, I married your father. He didn't have a high school education. He worked in his factory all of his life. So money isn't everything. And no matter how much Mr. Smarty Pants you think you are, you got to find the right person. And you can't have a big attitude and think you're a big shot. You have to find the right person, because I picked your father, and although we had very little money, although we struggled, my mom worked part-time taking ads for the local newspaper, although we struggled, we never amassed a lot of money, I was absolutely ecstatically happy every single day of my life with your dad and you two boys. So my mom impressed upon me this idea that family matters, that relationships matter, and then it dawned on me. I moved 17 times since I left graduate school. There's a third big decision that we make in our life that nobody ever taught me about and nobody ever told me about. And here I am in this great field called city planning, urbanism, geography, community development. I should know better. If anyone, I should know better. I've written about how place is important in our lives. The rise of the creative community. And here I was moving 17 times and just going about doing it with no rhyme or reason. So I said, if economics can tell you about a job in business schools, if psychology and people can tell you about a relationship, there's a third. There's the what to do, there's the who to marry, and there's the where we live. And I said, I have to write a book that digs into this theme of why where we live is important. And so here's the backgrounding to the book. In an age of globalization, technology, overcoming borders. In an age when there are so many things which are pulling us apart and causing things to locate all over the world, in fact, place and location are becoming more important than ever before to our economy, to our society, and to our lives. For the first time in human history this year, 50% of all people on the face of the earth live in urban city centers. First time this has happened. We cross the threshold. According to my estimates, if you look at the world, if you really map the world, and we use satellite maps to do this, if you really, and extract this, if you really want to think of the real map of the world, there are 40 mega-regions, Boston, New York, Washington corridor, Greater London, Greater Tokyo, Cascadia, that's Seattle, Portland, Vancouver, Ambrustwerp, we come up with all kinds of funny names, Ambrustwerp in Europe, Tor, Buffchester, the mega-region we're in today. 40 of these things account for 2/3 of the world's economic output and 90% of all of our innovation. So in that sense, we talk about the world being not just flat, Tom Friedman's idea of a flat, we talk about the world developing in a concentrated way, the world being developed around these mountain ranges of economic activity, these 40 mountain ranges, spikiness, tremendous spikiness in our world, tremendous clustering of economic activity, and I caution. I say a big part of our economy today is a trade-off we all have to make. In my life, I had to leave behind that Italian family, all of that love, all of the people, all of the relatives. To find my way in my career, I had to become a mobile person. And what I say in that book is that this is going to confront each and every one of our lives. This tension between being mobile for career, and being around family and friends. And that increasingly, I say to people, you're going to have to be aware of this. I talk in the book about relationships. And I talk about the three big moves. You're going to make a big move. And with graduation coming up, boy, oh, boy, moms and dads, if you spend all that money to put your kid in college, the biggest decision they're going to make that's going to have the biggest effect on their life is not where they went to college. It's where they move after college. It's the single biggest shaping decision on a young person's life. If they're in the wrong place with the wrong job market and not a lot of people, they'll start to sink. If they're in the right place with the right job market, the right opportunities, lots of networking opportunities, they'll thrive. And I talk about the three big moves. After college, not when you get married, but when the kids come, and then when the kids leave the house, when you're a quote-unquote empty nester. And I say that after college decision, think about it, the thriving career market. I had a young man working for me in Washington, D.C. He said, it's so important I came to Washington, D.C., lived in Iowa. He said, Rich, I can sample 15 different careers. I can work in foreign policy, security studies, public policy, economic development. I can work with you as an editor. He quit working for me as an editor. He is now as a rock band. He's on a world tour. He said, I can try them all out here, and I don't have to move. It's like a giant postgraduate training center, and Toronto even more so. It's a bigger city. So, and we know the young people are concentrating in the Torontos, the Chicagos, the Vancouvers, the New Yorks. They're coming. They're moving. I call this the great wave of migration. But think about the ability to meet and marry somebody. You know, I say in the book, if the job is an important decision, who you meet and marry is going to be an even important one. I talk about how some of these cities have enormous groups of young people, lots of people to meet, and people, when we ask them in a survey what's important, meeting and getting to know people, make new friends. The thing that really started to sell the book is when we had the gender ratios. We had we have a map, we call it the singles map, and we showed the ratios, best places for guys, best places for girls. And certain cities have a tremendous imbalance. There are certain cities that have 100,000 or more single women, certain cities that have 100,000 or more single men. But that's going to have a huge effect when you have a family, when you have kids, that environment. And then we talked about in a major survey that not only, with the Gallup organization, not only is it going to affect your economics and your family life, it's going to affect your psychology. And this has been a new learning for me. And I don't want to go into the details, but I want to make this point just crystal clear. If you want to have a happy life, if you want to have a fulfilled life, if you want to be psychologically well-balanced, what people will tell you is that money is useful, but it's not going to get you there. Money is not even half the story. What people will tell you is you've got to find work that's challenging and exciting and that you love. If you want to have a happy and fulfilled life, you've got to do work that you love, that challenges you, that you identify with, that allows you to self-express. Number two, that tells you you've got to be surrounded by loving personal relationships. The more of that you have in your life, the more of that you have with your family and friends and relatives and peer groups, the more happiness, the more filled your happiness bucket is. What nobody figured out until we wrote this book, Who's Your City, is that place is the third leg in that triangle. That as much as you need to have a fulfilling job and career, as much as you need to have great loving relationships and close relationships to family and friends, it is critically important that you find the place that fits you best. And what that book is saying is it's not just that you can rank, you know, Vancouver number one, got a number one in a recent ranking, that's why I picked them, and then number two is Sydney. You know, number three is Melbourne, Australia. Number four is Geneva, Switzerland. Number five is London. Number six is New York. Toronto was 13 on one of these lists. Still pretty good, though, by the way. But I said, that's lovely. That's important. And we do that in the book. We show ratings and rankings. What's really important is that you find the place that fits you. Who's your city? And what I say in that book, it's not always the big city. And I know we know this, but some people like me like the hustle and the bustle of the big city. We're urbanites, urbanists. Other people love to be in a suburban environment with a big lot, and they like their car and all. And then other people like to be in a more rural area. Well, anyway, I just want to end. I want to end on a story. And I think the story is useful. I think the story is useful because it will relate to you why this creative economy, how it grows, and why the sources of inspiration in our lives can come from strange places. And why, even if some of us are thinking about building the high-tech, strong, booming city, why even we have to rethink some of our premises? I went to Seattle. This was now 15 years ago. I went out to Seattle to help the city fathers of Seattle think about how to remake Seattle. And they were taking me around the downtown of Seattle. I was just in Seattle. It's wonderful now. It was not like that. It was really, 15 years ago, kind of run down. Amazon.com was barely starting. Starbucks was a little tiny, teeny company. All the other things, Costco didn't exist. All the other things that have kind of grown in Seattle. Boeing was moving its factories, the airplane factories around the world. Downtown Seattle was run down. Now, it was beginning to get some interesting people moving down. The gay community, arts community, writer community. They showed me some coffee shops that were coming into downtown. And one of the things they were really proud of is they had a wonderful independent bookshop. So they showed me all of this. Can we leverage? Now think about this. City Fathers, Rich, can the coffee shop and the bookstore, can we regrow our town around these two things? Well, sure, guys, you know, keep going. Positive reinforcement. So I saw this building in the background. The building, what it looked like was the construction site we've seen downtown Toronto. It's one of these swoopy kind of wood and metal things in the background. And I didn't know what it was because the architect wasn't famous yet. It was one of the Frank Gehry projects. They said, oh, we have this artist. He's wonderful, Frank Gehry. He's coming here to build this thing. It's going to be this very beautiful, curvaceous architecture. I'm like, well, why? Why are you building this in downtown Seattle? They said, well, there's a guy named Paul Allen in town. He's very, very wealthy, and he decided he wanted to build an institution, a new cultural institution, in Seattle that reflected what Seattle means to him. I didn't know who Paul Allen was. Maybe you don't either. Two first names, Paul Allen. They forgot the last name. I said, who the heck is Paul Allen? They said, you know Bill Gates, Rich? Yeah, I know Bill Gates. He's the guy who co-founded Microsoft with Bill Gates. He's like a multi-billionaire. He's the second richest man in the world. I'm like, oh, I wish I knew him better. And so I'm thinking now. I'm standing there on the corner in front of the independent bookshop next to the coffee store, looking over at the swoopy building, the swoopy wood construction project, curvaceous thing. What could this be? So the first thing that came into my mind is he's Paul Allen. He's a computer scientist. It's a science center, right? Duh. He's a scientist. He would be building a science center. I said, is this the new Seattle Science Center? You know, it's going to have the Einstein and Fermi and the physicists and the computer mathematicians. They said, no. It has nothing to do with science. Okay. Paul Allen, he's an inventor. He's an inventor. He's not a scientist. He actually didn't even finish college. He's an inventor like a Thomas Edison type. He's going to be motivated. So is it a center for invention, right? Discovery, where kids will learn how to take ideas and turn them into practical inventions. No. Okay. I'm thinking, I got one guess left, you know, and I'm really thinking now. This guy's richer than sin. So maybe what motivated him was money, right? He's just totally money-driven. It's a center for, we'll put the euphemism, entrepreneurship. A center for entrepreneurship to teach young people how to get rich. No, it has nothing to do with entrepreneurship. So now I'm totally puzzled. I'm like, what the heck is this thing? And the guy there, button down, tie, Chamber of Commerce guy, says straight-faced, well, Professor Florida, it's the Jimi Hendrix Experience Music Project. Now, this is, I wanted to be Jimi Hendrix, right? This is what I wanted to be. I'm on the floor. I mean, I'm on the floor. Here's Paul Allen, this rich billionaire software developer, inventor, the Jimi Hendrix Experience Music Project. And then it dawned on me. Techies, inventors, entrepreneurs, artists, the greatest computer science mind of our time and one of the leading billionaires and industry developers was influenced not by the techie or the inventor, but by a young black musician. Anyway, thanks for listening.